in back. It's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned. I
Confessions of a Casino Bandit.
Boom. The rear delivery door of the Red Lobster restaurant crashes open, and a small mob rushes through to fill the room. I'm on the back line of invading bodies. There's a television cameraman, his lights glowing golden. And about a pace behind, there's a reporter, microphone in hand. And somewhere, in the surging mix of heads and limbs and lights, there's an arm stretched out with one of those long, black boom microphones, snuffling for sound. And all that's very interesting, but it's the front line of this raid, the men with the guns, that has everyone's attention. There are police detectives, and with weapons leveled, they are screaming at someone to get up and face the wall. And since that someone is me, I do. I rise from the break room table, from the untouched baked flounder and sweet tea and cheese biscuits that was going to be my pre-shift meal. I rise in front of a half dozen recoiling co-workers, their confused eyes now on a swivel from the gleaming chrome of the detective's guns to the targeted center of my chest. Confused, they have no idea what this is about, but I do. So I rise, and I turn. I get my face jammed against the spackled wall, my hands and my freedom quickly jerked behind me, and it's over. I am the casino bandit, and I've been caught. My name is Michael Condiff. In the fall of 1995, in roughly a 60-day period of cowardice, stupidity, desperation, and general I-don't-give-a-fuckedness, I robbed 5 casinos in Nevada, 3 banks in Texas, and 2 more in California. My crimes were featured several times on the Fox television show America's Most Wanted, who eventually tagged me the Casino Bandit. I never watched the show, not then, and thus had no sense of a national noose that was tightening around me. On January 2, 1996, minutes before I was to clock in as a waiter at a Red Lobster in North Richland Hills, Texas, I was captured. Even in the spoiled, cynical suburbs of Dallas-Fort Worth, it was somewhat of a media event. In the car on the way to the town jail, my captors literally whooped and high-fived each other. As we approached the station, a call came over the car radio, alerting the driver that the local news crews had not set up yet, and they were clamoring for footage of the perp walk. So they drove me around the block once more to give the media what they wanted. A few nights later, from the felony tank of the Tarrant County Jail in Fort Worth, I finally did watch America's Most Wanted and flinched as host John Walsh informed the nation that I was facing more than 120 years in prison. I wanted to cry. I wanted to puke. I wanted my mama. My mother died 2 days before my 20th birthday. And there are folks who say that's where my dive began. I don't necessarily believe that's true, but I don't discount it either. Her death, from a heart attack at age 44, left me with a great sense of urgency. I wanted everything now, right now. Instead of completing a journalism degree at the University of North Texas, I took a job as a sports writer for a small suburban Dallas newspaper. And within a year, I had a wife. And within two, there was a daughter and a new position as one of the youngest sports editors of a daily newspaper in the state of Texas. Within 4 years, there came a son and two more advancements to larger salaries and larger responsibilities at larger dailies. But there was something else that I had, an addiction to gambling. On our honeymoon in June of 1987, my wife and I stopped at a Greyhound racetrack in my hometown of Pensacola, Florida. We had fun. We made our $2 bets on these quick little four-legged creatures and watched them run in circles. Some we'd win and some we'd lose, and she was happy either way. But it infected me. The notion that I could make money right now just by figuring out a puzzle, which animal would cross the finish line first, seeped into my system. It seemed fairly simple, especially to a guy who always considered himself the smartest man in the room when it came to anything sports related. And it appealed to what had become my life's rhythm, urgency. In 20 or 30 seconds, you either won or you lost, and either way, there was another test of your mettle coming 10 minutes later. If you lost, don't worry about it. Here comes another chance to prove yourself. If you won, well, can you do it again? So by the time my son was born in 1990, my habit was in full degenerative bloom. Two or three times a week, I would lie to my wife, tell her I was going off to cover some mythical sporting event, when in reality, I was driving 3 hours each way from Dallas to the thoroughbred tracks in Shreveport or Oklahoma City. On many occasions, I would bawl the entire 180 miles. I mean, full-fledged, snot-running, open-sobbing, emotional breakdown. But I could not stop from going. And when I'd leave the track, more times than not having lost everything in my wallet but the gas money to get home, I'd swear to myself that I'd never go back. And that promise would last for about the first 60 miles. By the last 60, I'd be organizing my plan of attack for the next venture. Where could I get more money? What lie could I tell my wife this time? As it turned out, the lies weren't entirely believed anyway. One night, my wife sat next to me at the foot of our bed and asked me, "How can you risk your family's security like this?" And I was paralyzed. I had no answer. So it should not have come as a surprise when she checked out of the marriage a year later. But it did. And as a man, as a human being, I descended to the most shameful depths. I begged her. I got down on my knees and pleaded her in public. I stalked her. I kicked in doors and I threatened her with a kitchen knife. I struck her. Put my hands around her throat, and I did worse. And most of it in full view of my kids. She never pressed charges, and I didn't fight when the divorce went through and she gained full custody of the kids. I didn't fight when she remarried and her new husband, a good man, petitioned to adopt the kids as his own. I didn't fight when they stopped calling me Daddy and started calling me Michael. I didn't fight anything. Certainly not against the undertow current of my life. From 1991 to 1995, I held 14 different jobs, four of them as newspaper editors. And I walked out of every single one once I had what I thought was enough money to hit the racetrack again. But it was never enough. In one position, as the night auditor of an airport motel in Fort Worth, I slinked off in the middle of the night with everything in the till and in the safe. And within 48 hours, it was all gone. The owner of the hotel tracked me down, said I could come back to work, that he would take half of my paychecks until the money was repaid in full. And then he said that he would personally break my legs if the register came up so much as a dollar short. And two nights later, I cleaned him out again. So, in early September 1995, I found myself near broke at a motel in San Marcos, Texas, watching the late news. There was a story about a man who had robbed several banks in Florida using only a handwritten note, and I decided, tomorrow, I'm going to rob a bank. So this girl is in her early 20s, Latina, pretty. She has these sky-colored eyes that are misting over, and these heavy-creamed coffee lips that are trembling in this whisper of words that I just can't believe. And she says, I don't have any money. And I'm standing there, balding at 29, in a sweatshirt that should have been thrown out long ago, with every molecule buzzing, every sense on overload, wired and incredulous, with my right hand held to the waistband of my jeans, to the plastic butt of a child's toy cap gun that I bought at Walmart because I wanted the form for effect. And I just say, what? And I'm dry mouthed and I'm desperate. What? And so the girl slides open the drawer, and it's basically empty. There's a few loose bills, but nothing more. And I'm panicking now. So I scratch the scribbled note from where she left it on the counter, and I step quickly to the left, and inexplicably mutter, excuse me, to the guy that I nudge out of the way to get to the next available teller. And this one is older, she's prim. She's probably been through this before. She scans the note quickly and then looks at me with the disappointment of a mother catching her son watching porn and calmly pushes across a stack of papered green. And I grab it and I'm out the door. I leap a rail. I find the car that I've backed in for a quicker exit. I toss the cash into the passenger side floorboard uncounted. Maneuver through the mall parking lot and hit Interstate 35 heading north out of Austin. The traffic's heavy. It's a getaway Friday afternoon. And then I hear the first sirens. And a second later, I see the flashing lights. But they're on the other side of the interstate. And they fly right past me. So I pull off and I tuck the car behind a Chili's. And I go inside and order one of those chocolate shakes with the sprinkles that they serve in an iced mug. And my heart is running like a lawnmower. And I have no spit. The take's about $1,300. And I lose it all in less than 2 days. On Monday morning, I pass another note at a bank in Hearst, Texas, just outside of Dallas. And the teller cooperates and hands me this bundle of cash, but she slips in a little surprise. Outside, as I'm jogging to my car, I hear this burst, like a balloon popping. And then suddenly, my right hand is on fire, and there's a quick, thick, rose-colored smoke billowing up from between my fingers. An explosive dye pack has gone off inside the bundle of money, and it's burning into my flesh. The heat is too much. I drop the cash and the bills peel off and flutter away in a pink breeze. And I get in the car and drive to this nearby McDonald's and dash into the restroom to run cold water over my hand, which is now covered in a thick blister and stained dark red. I'm in pain, but more than that, I'm pissed off. So I drive up the road a few miles into Irving, Texas, right near the Cowboys Stadium, and I pass another robbery note at another bank. And this time the haul is about $2,500, and thankfully no dye packs. But now I've just robbed two banks in one morning, and I figure it's time to get the fuck out of Dodge. So I go to Love Field Airport and look for flights that are leaving town, and I see one going to Las Vegas, the gambler's mecca, in a place that I had never been before. So I fly in, and I felt like Dorothy must have felt like when she first saw Oz. It was just overpowering. But within a week, I'm tapped. And so I decide to rob a cashier's cage in the San Remo Casino. The teller asks me if I'm serious when I hand him the note, and when I say yeah, he actually cautions me, warns me a little, says something like, "Man, I hope you know what you're getting into." And then he hands me approximately $7,500 in cash. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, broad daylight. The casino lobby's full of people checking out of the hotel, and I come sprinting through, out the double glass doors, back to my motel room. I change clothes quickly and head right back out into the street in time to see the police cars surrounding the San Remo. And I walk right past them and across the avenue into the MGM Grand and stay there till about 4 o'clock in the morning. The next day, I fly into Reno. I like that it's much smaller than Vegas, but Reno doesn't like me. In a few days, I'm broke again, and I rob the Fitzgerald's Casino downtown. From there, it's back to Vegas and then to San Francisco, where I spend a week playing the ponies at Bay Meadows in San Mateo. But the money well runs dry, so I coax a cab driver into parking behind two adjacent banks near Hillsdale Mall. I walk in the back door of one, out the front, turn left, and into the front door of the neighboring bank. I pass my note, I collect the cash, I retrace my steps. By noon of the same day, I'm in Reno. By midnight, I have no money left. So I rob the Silver Legacy, getting $10,000. I head to Southern California and spend a week at Santa Anita. I go broke. I rob another bank. Another dye pack goes off, but this time I'm quick enough to separate it from most of the cash and keep it away from my skin. I head back to Vegas. I go broke. I rob Harrah's on the Strip. I fly to New Orleans and into Louisville and then back to Vegas. I go broke. I spend 2 hours staking out the Westward Ho Casino, deciding which teller I want to approach with my note demanding $25,000 or else. I select a woman, mid-40s and tired looking. I hand her the note. She looks me dead in the eye and tells me basically to fuck off. I say, "Lady, I'm serious." And she says, "So am I." And there's nothing I can do. I turn around and walk out. No alarms go off. No one chases me. But I am defeated. A day later, I walk into a Denny's and eat a piece of coconut cream pie. On the back of the check, I scribble a robbery note and hand it to the cashier. When he tries to give me everything in the till, I tell him I only won $100, enough to get me a bus ticket back to Dallas. I move in with my father and the holidays approach. I get a job as a waiter at Red Lobster. Weeks go by and no one knocks at the door looking for me. Weeks go by and I begin to think, did I just get away with that? Christmas comes and I spend the day with my daughter, now 7, and my son, now 5. New Year's comes and I get drunk with friends. 2 days later, the restaurant drawer crashes in and they come for me. Did you really do what they're saying you did? My father asked from the other side of the visiting room plexiglass just hours after my arrest. When my reply is, yeah, Dad, I did. He just shakes his head and laughs a little. He says, holy shit, son, you're in some trouble. In the end, the 120 years John Walsh ominously predicted was trimmed way down. Across 4 jurisdictions, I served exactly 13 years and 2 days. In that span, I spent time in 11 penitentiaries and 6 jails. I went before 5 different judges and crossed the country 4 times shackled in the back of an extradition van. And in that span, I saw men get their throats cut, men stabbed, men beaten to death with softball bats, assaulted with cans of mackerel stuffed into sweat socks, thumped with mop ringers, bashed with television sets. I saw men jumped 4-on-1, 5-on-1, 10-on-1. I heard the scream and then the thud of a man being thrown off the 4th tier of a cell block, and I heard the plea of a man about to be raped. I worked the fields in the unbearable Texas summer where the boss men and women train their horses to bite you on the shoulder if you're working too slow, where if you decide not to work, they hogtie you and throw you onto the back of a flatbed metal trailer to sizzle until the day is done, where with my ears ringing from a heat exhaustion and my entire right arm covered by a leaking sun blister, I was told to either pick up an Aggie and make the grass lay down or go to the hole. And on a field farm in the Texas Department of Corrections, you don't want to go to the hole. So I worked. I survived 15 months at the maximum security United States Penitentiary in Beaumont, Texas, where life sentences were the norm rather than the exception, and therefore most of the population had nothing left to lose. This was the most violent stretch. This was a place I wasn't sure that I would leave alive, but I did, and then spent nearly 8 years in the Nevada desert, mostly at the Lovelock Correctional Center, which is a desolate place that's slightly famous now as the home of one Oriental James Simpson. Here time slid by, and here I turned 35 and then 40. Here I watched men get released and then watched them return and became disgusted. Here I met men who will never be released, men who will never have a second chance at life, and it bothered me because I knew that one day I would go free, and the space between our worlds was negligible. And then finally, I came to California, to the shit-stained, cramped walls of San Quentin's West Block, and then to the racially divided dorms of the California Correctional Center in Susanville, from where I was released on January 4th of this year. Today I live in a halfway house right in the heart of San Francisco's Tenderloin District. Halfway is the perfect description because the tenants are only part free. There are rules and there are curfews. Violations could land you out on the street or back in prison. And I will not go back to prison. I exist under dual supervision, 3 years of parole from the state of California, 3 years of probation from the feds. If they ask me to hop on one leg, I hop. The adjustment is more difficult than I ever imagined it would be. The world has changed. I have changed. In many ways, I've been institutionalized. There are things I'm used to doing at certain times every day, and that routine has been interrupted by the responsibilities inherent with freedom. It throws me off sometimes. If I don't work out every day, which is an absolute must on the inside if you have any hope of survival, I kind of feel out of sorts. At 4 o'clock, count time in the penitentiary, I have a sense there's somewhere I should be. Technology and the internet, an infant when I was arrested, have me frustrated beyond description. There are amazing people on my side, and that makes me nervous. If it was just me, I could deal with whatever happens from here. But there are friends and family in my corner, and the possibility of disappointing them again is nauseating. And then there are the two kids that I haven't seen since that Christmas day a week before I was arrested. They are young adults now and complete strangers. I look at their pictures on this Facebook thing and feel like I'm invading their privacy. Our phone conversations carry no spark, and it rips at me. Sad. I take night classes at City College of San Francisco, possibly towards nailing down that once spurned journalism degree. In the mornings, I act as an adult education tutor through the Federal Work Study Program. And in the afternoons, I look for full-time work. But there isn't much call for former sports writers turned casino bandits. It's hard to explain a 13-year lapse in your work history. It's hard to say, trust me. And I'm sure it's even harder to do.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.